is it. We are in the big faith chapter, chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews. Got a question to ask you here. Gonna ask you a question, see if you've been paying attention for the last couple months here. All right, get ready. Get your sharpened number 2 lead pencil and your eraser, because no, you don't need an eraser. You're gonna get it right. I'm confident in you. We've made great progress here. Huge strides in our education upon the book of Hebrews. This is Martin Zender, by the way. Hello, everyone. This is my question. Why is the chapter on faith, this is the chapter that's always quoted when people are talking about faith. It comes from Hebrews. Now, isn't that strange? You would think that a lot of it would come from Paul, from Paul's letters, and some of it does, but this is called the faith chapter. There's no chapter in Paul called the faith chapter. Actually, Paul's just saturated with it, so he doesn't have to pay special attention to it. I guess it's everywhere. If it's everywhere, no need pointing it out. But here, the faith chapter, why would it be? Why would it be? All right, so I'm hearing the correct answer is that, yes, the Hebrews had the kingdom pulled out from under them, and they were looking for it. There are people of sight, people of sound, people of sense, and they don't see the kingdom. So now they just have to believe that another era has come, a new administration has been interjected into their history, like inserting a book into a spring-loaded bookcase. And they're like, what happened? And so by faith now that they're called upon to exercise great faith. And in this chapter, we're going to see listed heroes of faith. And these heroes of faith are set before them, examples of people who didn't see nothing and still believed, examples of people who didn't have the luxury of evidence, didn't have the luxury of substance, which will bring us to the King James translation of Hebrews 11:1, which is ridiculous, erroneous, and stultifying. So this chapter is huge. So look at the development here in the book of Hebrews. We have a case made for Jesus Christ being the Messiah. We have a case being made for his priesthood being superior to the Aaronic priesthood. We have a case being made for the promises here being more excellent, and the source of the promises, the celestial source, being more fine, more sure. And we have the promise that God himself is going to do all this. And so we have the progression. And with all this fanfare, you expect the kingdom now to roll out. No, that's the problem. From 1 through 10, we have the fanfare about better promises, better expectation, better high priest, and how superior he is to everything, the ultimate sacrifice to the many, many animal sacrifices. So now we're going to roll out the kingdom, right? No, now we're going to tell you, and it's been slowly introduced, starting in chapter 10:25, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. And I might think, well, why would we do that? Well, because you've been kind of like bamboozled here. Shouldn't put it that way, because God doesn't bamboozle people. But he does do tricky things. I'm telling you, he does tricky things. As my friend Dan Sheridan will say, can't God do anything straight? You know, as the crow flies, in a straight line. No, he doesn't. Just look at the map of the Exodus, the harebrained scheme Israel takes getting out of the wilderness, not to mention the 40 years wandering, going around and around and around. It's worse than the YMCA track. 21 laps to the mile at the YMCA track, but I'm done in less than 40 years. So here God is, he sets forth this timetable for Israel in Daniel chapter 9, is it? Or is it chapter 7 when he talks about the heptads? The 77s of years, 490 years in Israel's history to the coming of Messiah and the completion of the sacrifice and to the trial at the end. But the time's not reckoned when Israel is in apostasy. For instance, it wasn't reckoned during the 70 years exile in Babylon. So it's always, you can always see the facts afterwards. You can see where God did it reasonably, but you just don't expect it. He throws a curveball, never throws right over the plate. It ends up coming over the plate, but like a true curveball, it looks like it's going way out yonder, and then it comes around, you're standing there holding the bat, like, what was that? Yeah, you just missed a beautiful pitch. So these are beautiful pitches, but there's sinkers, there's sliders, there's spitballs. No, you're right, I shouldn't accuse a guy of throwing a spitball. In a league where spitballs are legal, God is throwing spitballs. Speaking of baseball now, not the kind of spitballs we did in school. I mean, they did. I didn't do it. They did. I meant to say they did it. So let's see how the King James Version has screwed up Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, I'm going to read from the King James Version first. And tell me if you think this makes sense. Here's the King James Version, Hebrews 11, 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I'm going to read it again here. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, the only problem with that is it's completely wrong every way you look at it. Faith is neither substance nor evidence. Faith isn't substance. Substance is something you can touch, you can feel. You don't need faith for that. Faith is substance. Wrong. Right off the bat, wrong. Substance of things hoped for. The hoped for is wrong, too. I'll tell you about that in a second. The faith is the evidence of things not seen. It's not evidence. I mean, do you have any evidence that Jesus Christ lived apart from these words? I mean, that's not exactly evidence. We're taking somebody's word for it. In court, you can't just take somebody's word for it. They have Exhibit A, Exhibit B, and Exhibit A, B, C, D, E. They're not people's words. They're like a gun with fingerprints on it, right? A splintered piece of a door or something the killer left behind. Evidence. It's not evidence. So there's a major translating issues going on here. Now I'm going to read this from the Concordant Version. Now listen to this. This makes sense. Now, faith is an assumption of what is being expected, a conviction concerning matters which are not being observed. Isn't that beautiful? A conviction. Yeah, we can live with that. A conviction concerning matters which are not being observed. King James there has evidence. Now, why the there's a reason, believe me. Tomorrow, I'll look into these words. I'm not prepared to do that right now, to go into the etymology here in the Greek, but I'm going to do that, find out why the heck the King James, if you're interested. There's a reason the King James translated it incorrectly, and the Concordant translated it correctly, consistent with other places that word occurs in the Greek text. So, again, faith is neither substance nor evidence, and the true reading here assures us of that. Oh, the hoped for. Forget about it. Forget about that word hoped for. Substance of things hoped for. One of the great improvements in the Concordant Version over your standard English translations is it takes this word commonly translated hope and it makes it expectation. Faith is an assumption of what is being expected. We assume that something is going to happen. We assume it and expect it. I'm reading now from A. E. Nock commentary. This is a great sentence. Listen to this. Faith assumes that to be truth, which it expects to become fact in the future. That one sentence is the price of admission to this show right there. I'm going to read it again. Faith assumes that to be truth, which it expects to become fact in the future. In the future. This is what the Hebrews are having laid out for them. The future. And it's not a hope. I hope it happens. Faith is a substance of things hoped for. Screwy on both ends. The substance of things hoped for? You can't see it. It's not a substance. And we're not hoping for something. I hope God could bring the kingdom. No. This is a very strongly written letter. It's a letter of expectation. Paul's telling them to expect the kingdom and to assume it. You know, when people assume something, usually it's bad. You know, you assume I'm going to just work on that project for you. You assumed that, didn't you? You know, don't be so assumptuous. I just made up that word possibly. But here, it's a good thing because God is flattered. Well, I just assume God's going to do it. Duh. What a beautiful word when you just assume that God is true to his promises. So faith is an assumption. An assumption. In this case, it's good. Usually we think of that in a negative form. Faith is an assumption of what's being expected. Yeah, I expect it. I'm assuming God's going to do it. I'm expecting him to do it. That sounds bold and audacious. And people usually tiptoe up to God. They don't like to be this bold with God. How dare you say you expect God to do something? I expect you to take care of that. You know, usually your parents tell you that or your teacher in school. But we're saying this to God. I expect you to take care of that. God likes it. God likes it when we say that. This word hope is wimpy. I hate this word, and it's a wrong translation of a Greek word. I don't know what the Greek word is, but tomorrow night I will know what the Greek word is. Man, I'm setting myself up to do a lot of homework. And a conviction. God likes that. What does King James say there? The evidence. All right, evidence and conviction, two obviously different words. I'm convinced, in other words, concerning matters. Matters. I like that word too, matters. It's the Greek word pragma, practice, effect. These are things concerning matters which are not being observed. And that's the tricky part. Matters. So it's almost like it sounds substantive. It sounds like you can grab it, put your hands on it. Matters. But these matters concerning which Paul wrote were not being observed. The king, i.e., the kingdom. How much time do I have left here? Oh my goodness, no. All right, I'm at 12 minutes, but I'm going to give you a quick read in this next phrase, and this is the most unintelligible verse I know of in the entire scriptures. And if anybody can tell me what this means, I'd be happy. I think A.E. Nock tried to explain it to me once, not in person, but all right, first this though. Let me read verse 1 and 2, then I'm going to the end of verse 2, and or verse 3 is going to freak you out. I'm not going to explain it tomorrow to the best of my ability. I'm going to explain that part of it that I know, but there's part of this phraseology that it sounds like a different language to me. I know it was translated out of a different language, but the translation sounds like a different language. Now, faith is an assumption of what is being expected, a conviction concerning matters which are not being observed, for in this the elders were testified to. And we're going to get to that. This is going to be delicious. All through this chapter, we're going to hear from these elders, these men of God and women of God in the faith were testified to because of their faith. Now, here's the screwy statement. Sorry, it's in verse 2. By faith, we are apprehending the eons to adjust to a declaration of God so that what is being observed has not come out of what is appearing. Yeah. What is being observed has not come out of what is appearing. That is unintelligible to me, and it ticks me off that the translation couldn't be better. Maybe Knock just didn't know what it was. Anyway, but I have a slight, I have a bit of an insight into that, and I'm going to give you that tomorrow, and we're going to look into some of these words just to give you confidence in the conviction here and give you an assumption concerning the assumption. I've been rubbing my hands together for 2 months getting ready for this chapter, and we're going to dig into it together.